So I'd like to wish everyone a Happy New Year. Of course, for devotees, happiness means spiritual happiness, right? And whatever it takes to become spiritually happiest is what we're seeking. So sometimes Krishna tests us by the school of hard knocks. He tests our faith and he tests our surrender, and if we pass the test, then we become truly spiritually happy, regardless of whatever is going on materially in our lives. So that's real happiness, not the type of happiness that is fleeting and temporary. So when we say Happy New Year, we're wishing everyone a spiritually happy and healthy and spiritually prosperous New Year. Right? And for the devotees, for the Vaishnavas, actually the New Year is the anniversary of the birth of Lord Chaitanya. That's when our New Year starts. But for the sake of social convention, we wish each other a Happy New Year, and there's certainly no harm in that. So Happy New Year today, and Happy New Year. Actually, every day is a beginning of a new year, right? In one sense. So every day we wish each other a happy rest of our lives. It's a very auspicious day today because it's the disappearance day of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And it's a wonderful way to welcome in the new year, because on the appearance and the disappearance days of the Acharyas, we are given more reason to focus on our spiritual lives by meditating on these great souls and by meditating on our relationship with them. And this is a very sobering experience. When we say sobering, we mean that it helps us to become sober in our understanding of who we are and what our function is in this world, as opposed to being intoxicated by the sense enjoyment of this material world. So sobering experience means that that days like today, meditating on the Acharyas, help us focus on who we really are. And even if it's just a little bit goes such a long way. If we pray in a very meaningful way, or if we listen to the pastimes of this great Acharya, or we hear his teachings, even just a little taste of that, the purity that these great souls emanate, elevates our consciousness in such a way that we can see things, or we wish to see things as they actually are. And we develop the desire, or more desire, to dedicate ourselves, or we rededicate ourselves to the mission of Lord Chaitanya, trying to follow in the footsteps of such great souls. And to be related, and the great fortune of being related to such a divine entity as Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, actually the entire disciplic succession, it's the greatest boon that we can ask for, to have the association of these inconceivably great personalities. If we think of the association that people who aren't as fortunate have, what association do they have that can enable them to make such great progress in spiritual life? They have no association at all. It's a desert out there. It really is. and the people who are looking for good association. Of course, Brahmanda, Brahmite, Kona Bhagavan Jeev, Guru Krishna Pasade by Bhakti Lata Bij, by Krishna's mercy, by some great fortune that Krishna bestows upon the soul. After wandering through millions and millions of planetary systems, births and deaths, by Krishna's mercy they come in contact with the bona fide spiritual master, and by the mercy of the bona fide spiritual master they get Krishna. So without that mercy, people are lost. And sometimes they choose not to accept the mercy when the spiritual master appears before them, or when Krishna appears before them. By way of the spiritual master, they choose not to accept such mercy. Even when Prabhupada was present, there were so many that refused to accept his mercy. So once a devotee asked Srila Prabhupada, why, how come we accepted Krishna consciousness and so many people didn't? Prabhupada said, because you're intelligent. And when Prabhupada said that, he wasn't referring to material intelligence, he was referring to spiritual intelligence, the ability to perceive the difference between spirit and matter, the controller of both, the ability to see things in their proper perspective. Once we hear that, somehow or other, we accept that. So Prabhupada said, because you're intelligent, we have to, now that we're here, we have to maintain our intelligence so that we can continue advancing. And so days like today help us fortify our understanding of who we are. And speaking of intelligence, most of us are familiar with the life and teachings of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. There's actually no one more intelligent, materially speaking, than he. I'm not sure how much Nityananda Prabhu mentioned about the life of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur this morning, but certain things stick out in my mind always, how he was able to not only memorize the Bhagavad Gita when he was how old? 7 years old. Not only did he have it memorized, but he was preaching it also at that age, preaching the Bhagavad Gita. And very soon after that, because he was able to remember everything that he read, he became the greatest scholar, even at a very young age. Became a great astronomer, astrologer. His teachers were so much fond of his ability to absorb material knowledge. They wanted him to go further and further and further. But actually he chose, when he was in, by the time he got to the university, he chose to leave school. And he chose to leave school. One way it was explained was that he didn't want to get married. And the more material qualifications that he had, the more he would be pushed into entering into grihastha life, which he did not at all want. He wanted to remain celibate his whole life, and he wanted to preach the message of Lord Chaitanya, because he understood that in spite of so much material qualification, in spite of so much material knowledge, nothing had any value except the message of Lord Chaitanya. So he wanted to dedicate himself to preaching the message of Lord Chaitanya, in spite of everything that he had, all qualifications that he had. It's explained that one of the opulences of this material opulences of this world is the possession of knowledge, good birth, good looks, wealth, knowledge. These are opulences in this material world. And the more one has of these opulences, the more chance one has to misuse these opulences and utilize them for one's own material aggrandizement. So, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur had so much, it's inconceivable, they called him the walking encyclopedia. But in spite of all this, he chose to give all that up and utilize his intelligence to serve the Supreme Lord. So when we read what he has written, for example, we can see how he's utilized that intelligence in devotional service. Gave up the astrology, gave up the astronomy, gave up all the material knowledge. He wrote when he was very young also, I think it was when he was around 8 or 9 years old, he also wrote a shorthand language. He invented a shorthand language, which was completely unique. So he could have done anything that he wanted to do. He could have manipulated and controlled the material energy in so many different ways. But he chose not to do that. And instead he chose to utilize all of that intelligence in Krishna's service. So his second language was English. For many of us, most of us here, that's our first language. And although English was his second language, his vocabulary was far greater than, I would say, 99% of all English-speaking people. At the same time, if you've read any of what he has written, he writes in such a way that it could be considered very beautiful poetry. Not only did he understand the language, but he understood how to use it in such a way, even though it was very complicated, it was very beautifully put together in a way that increased the impact of what he wanted to say and the beauty of what he wanted to say. So I became inspired recently by various parts of a book that he had written, that he wrote, called the Sri Krishna Samhita. And there was a part of that book that was published in his magazine called The Harmonist. This is in 1932. A very beautiful section where of the Sri Krishna Samhita, where he explains very beautifully how all the demons that appeared in Krishna Leela, and also all the other souls who appear there that manifested some mischievous or demoniac qualities, how these demons and those, just like Lord Indra, Lord Brahma, they weren't demons, but they made a few mistakes. They committed a few offenses, like trying to annihilate everyone by the devastating rainfall, Govardhan, and Lord Brahma was very, very mischievous, very envious, couldn't see Krishna for who he was, and he tried to play a dirty trick on him by stealing all the cows and the cowherd boys. So all these demons and these various activities that other devotees and other souls committed, they all represent various anarthas or unwanted qualities that we all have, or that some of us have. Well, all of us have to some degree, some of us have to a greater degree. So they all represent various anarthas that people have in this material world. And it's very interesting how he explains, well, for example, the position of Kamsa. He's the one that got all the demons to do their demoniac, manifest their demoniac behavior, trying to kill Krishna. So he's like the fountainhead, the inspiration behind all these, the appearance of all these anarthas. And so he explains very nicely here what Kamsa's position is, and also in this particular section what Putana's position is. How Putana represents the false guru. What is that phrase? Oxymoron? How false guru, those two words don't really go together very at all, because if one is a false guru, one is not a guru, right? So in that sense, the combination of those two words doesn't make any sense. But we understand what it means. Someone who's pretending to be a guru, or someone who's trying to guide, trying to have influence, trying to impose one's influence, one's authority, representing oneself as an authority. So there are gurus that do that, and he's. It's very interesting the way he writes this, because in relation to Kamsa, in relation to Putana also, he shows how, well, I'll read it, but I'll just briefly explain how these false gurus, they don't just come in the form of someone who's trying to be a guru in the traditional sense, but they come in other forms as well, very interesting forms. So what I wanted to do tonight is read some of what Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur has written, so you can see the beauty of his writing and also the beauty of his message, which he so nicely puts. So you'll have to concentrate a lot when you hear this. Some of the sentences I'll read a couple of times so that I can understand them. And let's see how it goes. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So he's saying, Sri Krishna manifests his eternal birth in the pure cognitive essence of the serving soul who is located above all mundane limitations. Okay, I'll say that again. Sri Krishna manifests his eternal birth in the pure cognitive essence of the serving soul who is located above all mundane limitations. Okay, I'll explain what I think he means. Sri Krishna manifests his eternal birth, in other words, he manifests himself in the pure cognitive essence of the serving soul. The pure cognitive means the ability to experience, right? Of the serving soul. In other words, Krishna manifests himself to the sincere soul who has reached the point of being able to, the purity with which to perceive him. So Krishna manifests himself to the elevated soul who is located above all mundane limitations, right? So who does Krishna manifest himself to? Sri Krishna manifests his eternal birth in the pure cognitive essence of the serving soul who is located above all mundane limitations. Does that make sense? Yes? The experience. He manifests himself within the experience of the serving soul who is above the limitations of matter. In other words, who is the transcendental personality, the person who is transcendental to mundane limitations, to matter, the limitations of matter. Krishna manifests himself to that pure-hearted person. Yeah. He didn't say that, but that's how Krishna manifests. King Kamsa is the typical aggressive empiricist, materialist, Kamsa. He is ever on the lookout for the appearance of the truth, for the purpose of suppressing him before he has time to grow up. In other words, he's always on the lookout to suppress any type of expression or manifestation of Krishna before this manifestation of Krishna has time to develop within one's consciousness. He is ever on the lookout for the appearance of the truth for the purpose of suppressing him before he has time to grow up. So what did Putana do? As soon as Krishna appeared, Krishna comes to send Putana to squelch him. This is no exaggeration of the real connotation of the consistent empiric position. In other words, what he just said isn't an exaggeration of what's going on in this material world with people. The force of the material energy is so strong. Anytime there's some manifestation of spirituality, the force of the material energy is so strong, it tries to squelch it, put it out. That's what he's saying. The materialist has a natural repugnance for the transcendental, natural aversion. Doesn't like it at all, materialist. He is disposed to think that faith in the incomprehensible is the parent of dogmatism and hypocrisy under the guise of religion. I'll read it again. He is disposed to think that faith in the incomprehensible, in other words, faith in the spiritual, faith in Krishna, is the parent of dogmatism. In other words, that leads to all this dogmatic religious stuff like the Bhagavad, what is it? Bhagavad Gita. Parent of dogmatism and hypocrisy under the guise of religion. So that's what he thinks. That this, it's, you say it's religion, but it's just dogmatism and hypocrisy. That's all it is. Your faith in the divine. He is disposed to think that faith in the incomprehensible is the parent of dogmatism and hypocrisy under the guise of religion. He is also equally under the delusion that there is and can be no really dividing line between the material and the spiritual. In other words, he doesn't believe that there's a material and a spiritual. He believes whatever somebody might call spiritual is actually material. Because there's no such thing as a spiritual. He is strengthened in his delusion by the interpretation of the scriptures by persons who are like-minded with himself. In other words, they interpret the scriptures in a materialistic way. This included all the lexicographical interpreters. A lexicographical interpreter. Those are people who they take whatever terms that we understand spiritually, they take them as in terms of their dictionary definitions, lexicographical. Lexicography refers to dictionary definitions. Like, for example, God. If you just take the dictionary definition of God, he's like the controller and he's like the oldest, which means he has a long white beard. He's the father of all living entities. Okay, father, that means he also has a father. In other words, the materialistic understanding of these words, a dictionary understanding, materialistic dictionary understanding of these words. That's the lexicographical interpretation. So it's upheld by Kamsa as the real scientific explanation of the scriptures, and one that is perfectly in keeping with his dread and aversion of the transcendental. Just like, how can Krishna, if you take that dictionary meaning of God, the concept of Krishna just can't possibly exist. Krishna had girlfriends. He was a rascal. He did all these things. So if you understand these things in that particular way, it doesn't make any sense at all. So it's in keeping with their dread and aversion of the transcendental. In other words, they use this misinterpretation to negate our interpretation and our understanding of who Krishna actually is. These lexicographical interpreters are employed by Kamsa in putting down the first suspected appearance of any genuine faith in the transcendental. King Kamsa knows very well that if the faith in the transcendental is once allowed to grow, it is sure to upset all his empiric prospects. There is historical ground for such misgiving. Accordingly, if the empiric domination is to be preserved intact, it would be necessary not to lose a moment to put down the transcendental heresy the instant it threatens to make its appearance in the right earnest. King Kamsa, acting on this traditional fear, is never slow to take the scientific precaution of debuting empiric teachers of the scriptures backed by the resources of dictionary and grammar and all empiric subtleties to put down by the show of spacious arguments based on hypothetical principles the true interpretation of the eternal religion revealed by the scriptures. In other words, as soon as anything true pops up, he's right there to put it down before it can spread. Put it down by these false doctrines. So that's the principle of the false guru. Does this make sense? Kamsa is strongly persuaded that the faith in the transcendental can be effectively put down by empiricism if prompt and decisive measures are adopted at the very outset. He attributes the failures of atheism in the past to the neglect of the adoption of such measures before the theistic fallacy has time to spread among the fanatical masses. In other words, he says atheism has failed, all the Kamsas. Atheism has failed to the degree that it neglects to put down this theistic fallacy before it has time to spread. And when Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur was preaching, he was preaching against these caste Brahmins, preaching against the impersonalists and the voidists very, 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 very strongly. And in his time, in other words, what he's writing here can relate very much to the, what he was living during his time. And Prabhupada was also very much against these impersonalists and voidists. And in our time, it's in the form of the scientists. And of course, the Mayavadis too, and the impersonalists, but not so much as compared to what was prevalent in India. Although we see it now creeping in more and more. And Prabhupada was focused specifically on the on the scientists. And he understood the mission of his spiritual master, who was very much against and preaching so strongly to establish Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, to eradicate all these kamsas, all these false gurus, all these putanas. Prabhupada will be mentioning putana. He will be mentioning putana soon. So when Prabhupada wrote in his offering to his spiritual master, remember those lines? Absolute is sentient, thou hast proved. Impersonal calamity, thou hast, well, we say removed, but Prabhupada said moved, at least at one point. Prabhupada said, the absolute is sentient, thou hast proved. Impersonal calamity, thou hast removed or moved. So he was glorifying his spiritual master in that poem. And his spiritual master, he loved the poem, but he specifically, especially loved that particular phrase. Not just the way Prabhupada wrote it, but the fact that Prabhupada understood his mission. And he put it in such a beautiful way, that understanding in such a beautiful way. And we see that in the pranam mantra that Prabhupada has given us to chant, offering our respects to him, the same point is there. Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pacharani Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Dishatayani. That Nirvishesha Shunyavadi, that he's preaching the message of his spiritual master, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, so kindly freeing the world from impersonalism and voidism. So that same point is there. Again, and Prabhupada wanted us to recognize that in him, as he recognized it in his spiritual master. Not only recognized it in him, but just as Prabhupada followed in the footsteps of his spiritual master, we also have as our mandate to follow in Srila Prabhupada's footsteps by establishing Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead and ridding this world of impersonalism and voidism. So, and these materialists, they're in the same category. So, we'll continue with his explanation of the psychology of these personalities. Okay, then he says, got where I left off. And he says, but Kamsa is found to count without his host. When Krishna is born, he is found to be able to upset all sinister designs against those who are apprised by himself of his advent. In other words, Kamsa failed. The apparently causeless faith displayed by persons, irrespective of age, sex, and condition, may confound all rabid empiricists who are on principle averse to the absolute truth, whose appearance is utterly incompatible with the domination of empiricism. So the causeless faith, apparently causeless faith displayed by persons, by devotees, irrespective of their material situation. It confuses all these rabid, all these, what's another word for rabid? diseased. That's a good word. Diseased empiricists who are in principle averse to the absolute truth, whose appearance is utterly incompatible with the domination of empiricism. In other words, the devotees, the appearance of the devotees in this world is completely incompatible with the domination of empiricism. In other words, empiricism or materialism can't dominate if the devotees are prevalent. But no adverse efforts of the empiricists, whose rule seems till then to be perfectly well established over the minds of the deluded souls of this world, can dissuade any person from exclusively following the truth when he actually manifests his birth in the pure cognitive essence of his soul. In other words, once you experience Krishna consciousness, once you really experience it, there's nothing that can shake you from it. That's what he's saying. Yeah, I got it back. I'll read it again so you can understand it in light of how I explained it. But no adverse efforts of the empiricists, nothing they can do, whose rule seems till then, before they come up against devotees, whose rule it seems till then to be perfectly well established over the minds of the deluded souls of this world. No adverse efforts can dissuade any person from exclusively following the truth when he, or Krishna, actually manifests his birth in the pure cognitive essence of his soul. Then, Putana is the slayer of all infants. The baby, when he or she comes out of the mother's womb, falls at once into the clutches of the pseudo-teachers of religion. So here is the false guru, right? Just like when Krishna was born, Putana was right there, right? Kamsa was sure to make sure that Putana was right there. And what was her service? To kill all the newborn babies. It's the service of Maya, or the false guru, right? As soon as people are born into this world, what happens? They're killed by all these false gurus in the form of their materialistic surroundings, their materialistic influences. These teachers are successful in forestalling the attempts of the good preceptor, whose help is never sought by the atheists of this world at the baptisms of their children. So these false gurus, these putanas, these teachers, they're successful in forestalling the attempts of the good preceptor. In other words, they're successful in warding off the devotees, the good preceptor, whose help is never sought by the atheists of this world at the baptisms of their children. This is ensured by the arrangements of all the established churches of the world. So he's putting down, he's criticizing these materialistic religion here. That the children, they never get the true thing, the real thing. This is ensured by the arrangements of all the established churches of the world. They have been successful only in supplying watchful putanas for effecting the spiritual destruction of persons from the moment of their birth with the cooperation of their worldly parents. So pseudo-religion plus their materialistic parents finishes them off. No human contrivance can prevent these putanas from obtaining possession of the pulpits. In other words, there's nothing that can be done. This is due to the general prevalence of atheistic disposition in the people of this world. The church that has the best chance of survival in this damned world now you know where how that expression came. Damned means it's going to hell, right? It's damned. It is God damned. It's damned by God, right? We use that in a profane way, right? But that's where it came from. It's not a profane term, actually. It's just misused by people who are frustrated and want to say something very heavy. But it's a damned world. The church that has the best chance of survival in this damned world is that of atheism under the convenient guise of theism. So many churches. Big, huge churches. But what are they teaching? The churches have always proved the staunchest upholders of the grossest forms of worldliness, from which even the worst of non-ecclesiastical criminals are found to recoil. A non-ecclesiastical criminal is just a common criminal who couldn't care less about God. Even those people can't believe what's going on. I'll read it again. The churches have always proved the staunchest upholders of the grossest forms of worldliness, from which even the worst of non-ecclesiastical criminals are found to recoil. And they uphold these things in the name of religion, too. Just like killing people in the name of religion. Churches are famous for that. And they, even up to this day, what to speak of everything else. Just like someone was explaining how Bhakti Chaitanya Swami, he was explaining how Soho Street, the temple is near, well, there's a certain part of Soho Street, or the section called Soho. It's where all the brothels are, all the criminal stuff is going on. It's the most degraded part of London. Do you know who owns all that real estate and was renting it out? Catholic Church. Or the Church of England, whatever church is there. So they're behind it all. They could easily clean that up because they own it. And it goes on and on. It is not from any deliberate opposition to the ordained clergy that these observations are made. The original purpose of the established churches of the world may not always be objectionable. In other words, they started out with good intentions, just like this country, right, was founded on supposedly good intentions. In God we trust. But then those good intentions were lost due to the influence of more materialism. The original purpose of the established churches of this world may not be always objectionable, but no stable religious arrangement for instructing the masses has yet been successful. The Supreme Lord Sri Krishna Chaitanya, in pursuance of the teaching of the scriptures, enjoins all absence of conventionalism for the teachers of the eternal religion. In other words, he's completely against that. conventionalism, what's going on, or what's been going on, all the degradation, all the concocted religion, cheating religion. The Supreme Lord Sri Krishna Chaitanya, pursuance of the teaching of the scriptures, enjoins all absence of conventionalism for the teachers of the eternal religion. It does not follow that the mechanical adoption of the unconventional life by any person will make him a fit teacher of religion. In other words, it's like following the rules without understanding the purpose behind them, or following the rules mechanically without the proper understanding or devotion. It does not follow that the mechanical adoption of unconventional life by any person will make him a fit teacher of religion. Regulation is necessary for controlling the inherent worldliness of the conditioned souls, but no mechanical regulation has any value even for such a purpose. The bona fide teacher of the religion is neither any product or the favorer of any mechanical system. In his hands, no system has likewise the chance of degenerating into a lifeless arrangement. The mere pursuit of fixed doctrines and fixed liturgies cannot hold a person to the true spirit of doctrine or liturgy. The idea of an organized church in an intelligible form, indeed, marks the close of the living spiritual movement. The great ecclesiastical establishments are the dikes and the dams to retain the current that cannot be held by any such contrivances. Whoops. I lost them. I thought it was other dikes and dams. To retain the current. In other words, they can't help, they can't fight, yeah, they can't fight the advances of materialism. They're not pure enough, they're not strong enough to uphold real spirituality. That's what he's saying. They indeed indicate a desire on the part of the masses to exploit a spiritual movement for their own purpose. In other words, they're influenced by the masses. And we see so many religious institutions and so many religious doctrines becoming watered down by the influence of the people. They say, well, if we want to exist, if we want to expand, we're going to have to change our doctrine a little bit and allow for this and allow for that and allow for this and not really pay much attention to that. That's what he's saying here. They also unmistakably indicate the end of the absolute and unconventional guidance of the bona fide spiritual teacher. These religions, these organized religions. The people of this world understand preventive systems. They can have no idea of the unprevented, positive, eternal life. Neither can there be any earthly contrivance for the permanent preservation of the life eternal on this mundane plane on the popular scale. In other words, there's nothing material that can nothing materially Dharma Projita Kaitavo Chara There's no cheating religion that can, none of these religions can give what's really needed within human society. Neither can there be any earthly contrivance for the permanent preservation of the life eternal on this mundane plane on the popular scale. Is everybody paying attention? Are you trying to? Or am I the only one who's? I'm looking at this, so it's a lot easier for me, looking at the words, and I'm really relishing the way he's putting all these sentences together. But if you're having too much difficulty with following this, it is, it's too difficult. It's okay, it's sort of okay, más o menos, more or less. Well, I'll just read a little bit more, then we can. I'm almost done, actually. Two more paragraphs. Okay, so give it everything you have right now. Those are, therefore, greatly mistaken who are disposed to look forward to the amelioration of the worldly state in any worldly sense from the worldly success of any really spiritual movement. Those are, therefore, greatly mistaken who are disposed to look forward to the amelioration, what is it, coming together? Coming together? Coming together of the worldly state. So they're mistaken to think that things will come together in any worldly sense from the worldly success of any really spiritual movement. Improvement. From the worldly success of any really spiritual movement. What does amelioration mean again? Improvement. Okay. Those are therefore greatly mistaken or disposed to look forward to any improvement of the worldly state in any worldly sense from the worldly success of any really spiritual movement. Oh, in the worldly sense. Okay, so any really spiritual movement, that's not the goal of a spiritual movement, I guess. It is these worldly expectants who become the patrons of the mischievous race of the pseudo-teachers of religion, the Putanas, whose congenial function is to stifle the theistic disposition at the very moment of its suspected appearance. That was okay. Did you get that? Okay. I'll read it again, just to give us a little more confidence. It is these worldly expectants who become the patrons. All right, in other words, these people who are looking for material success, they won't find it in a spiritual movement. That was the meaning of the first... Those are therefore greatly mistaken who are disposed to look forward to the amelioration of the world, improvement of the worldly state in any worldly sense from the worldly success of any really spiritual movement. It is these worldly expectants, those people who expect worldly gains, who become the patrons of the mischievous race of the pseudo-teachers of religion, the Putanas, whose congenial function is to stifle the theistic disposition at the very moment of its suspected appearance.
Isn't that the same role of Kamsa also? Isn't that the same thing?
Yeah, that's what he's saying here. Kamsa, Putin, Kamsa sent Putin. Yeah, Kamsa was looking all over the place. But the real theistic disposition can never be stifled, even by the efforts of those Putanas. The Putanas have power only over the atheists. It is a thankless but salutary task which they perform for the benefit of their willing victims. But as soon as the theistic, this is the last paragraph, as soon as the theistic disposition proper makes its appearance in the pure cognitive essence of the awakened soul, in the heart of the awakened soul, as soon as Krishna appears. The Putanas are decisively silenced at the very earliest stage of their encounter with newborn Krishna, right? Newborn Krishna in our hearts, right? When Krishna appears in our hearts, nobody can shake us, right? That's what he's saying. not even the Putanas. The would-be slayer is herself slain. This is the reward of the negative services that the Putanas unwittingly render to the cause of theism by strangling all hypocritical demonstrations against their own hypocrisy. I'll read that again. This is the reward of the negative services that the Putanas unwittingly render to the cause of theism by strangling all hypocritical demonstrations against their own hypocrisy. But Putana does not at all like to receive her reward in the only form which involves the total destruction of her wrong personality. King Kamsa also does not like to lose the service of the most trusted of his agents. The effective silencing of the whole race of the pseudo-teachers of religion is the very first clear indication of the appearance of the Absolute on the mundane plane. The bona fide teacher of the Absolute heralds the advent of Krishna by his uncompromising campaign against the pseudo-teachers of religion. So, the more you read it, the more you can fit all the words together. It's very beautifully written. And this is the way he always wrote whatever he wanted to express. If you read his commentary to the Sri Brahma Samhita, you have to read it with a dictionary. This also, I needed a dictionary in a couple of places. So, of course, it's not the only way to express the Absolute Truth. Prabhupada expressed the same points in simpler language, easy for us to understand. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur spoke this way for a reason, and we can see how effective his preaching was, how appealing it was, how convincing it was. And you judge by the fruits how he spread Krishna consciousness all over, establishing the Gaudiya Math in a very strong way. And as soon as he saw Prabhupada, he knew. He had complete faith in Prabhupada, that Prabhupada could spread the same message to the Western world without even speaking to Prabhupada, just as soon as he saw him. So that's another indication of his inconceivable purity and potency, Shaktivesh, empowered by Krishna. So he knew Prabhupada could communicate the same message in the Western world. And that's why he asked Prabhupada to do that. And that's why he said, if you ever get money, print books. And he didn't mean just print them. He meant write them, as Prabhupada had been doing, with his back to Godhead, etc. Because he knew that Prabhupada could communicate this message to the Western world. And that was one of Prabhupada's as part of Prabhupada's divine legacy. He took the order of his spiritual master to heart, took it on his head, and spent hour after hour, day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, writing commentaries, and then getting them distributed so that he could spread the legacy of this chain of disciplic succession to the Western world. Always meditating. He said there was not a moment when I ever felt separated from my spiritual master, because he took that order on his head. He was always thinking about fulfilling it. His spiritual master was always present in his heart. So we're dedicated to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur only because Prabhupada was so dedicated. Because of Prabhupada's dedication, he was able to give us, he understood his spiritual master, he was able to give us his spiritual master. Not just facts about his life, but the mood of his spiritual master, which is the essence, the mood, the instructions. He gave them to us in a way that we could follow them. So Prabhupada said, and he was crying when he said it, he thanked us. He thought of us as representatives of his spiritual master that have come to help him fulfill the order of his spiritual master. So if we see these things in proper perspective, then, and we act on everything Prabhupada has taught us and directly about his spiritual master and through his following his spiritual master's instructions, if we see these things in the proper way and act on them, we'll be very, very close to Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Even though we might not use the same words, still we'll be preaching the message that he preached and that Prabhupada preached, and now that we are to preach. How to establish Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and how to eradicate this world from impersonalism and voidism. Jai Shri Shri Radhakala Chandra. And what better way than to bring everyone to the lotus feet of Shri Shri Radhakala Chandra. Who can deny that that is God standing there before us? Does anyone have any comments or questions? Yes, Prabhu.
The last paragraph reminded me of something that Radha Swami said in a lecture on the Ramayana. He was describing Hanuman's crossing to Lanka and the different obstacles that he was presented on his travel were also representing obstacles in devotional service. Mm. You know, one of them was wealth, the golden mountain. Mm. Another one was envy, the demon that grabbed his shadow. And so the last one was, so he got to Lanka, and the goddess of Lanka, like Lankeshwari, came and said, "What are you doing? You're a criminal coming on our land. You're a thief. Why are you coming here?" And so he was saying that the atheists, they speak in this way, "You're brainwashed." Mm. But he conquered it with this was the obstacle of bewilderment with his firm conviction. Yes. He said, "Actually, you're housing a rapist and a thief here. you're the criminal. What are you talking about? Right. Ravan's the criminal, and you're protecting
right.
him."
Just like Prabhupada said, "Who is crazy?" Right? I think it was 1969 or 1970, Prabhupada, they wrote a little thing, "Who is actually crazy?" In other words, same point. They're calling us crazy. But who's actually crazy? And we used to distribute that by the thousands. It's titled, "Who is Crazy?" And Prabhupada had a way of throwing it right back. Yes, we're brainwashed. Our brains are washed. Yes.
Well, thank you for coming and being with us tonight. I have two things. I hope they're on topic and with what we're saying. Mananath Prabhu, your godbrother, who is from Italy, he grew up with Catholic faith, and he gave a lecture to us down in San Antonio talking about how...
Can you hold it closer?
Yeah, it was very hard for Mananath Prabhu to adhere to this faith, the Catholic faith, in the end, because his inquiries were not being...
satisfied.
Yeah, and so he met Prabhupada. Prabhupada never told him to just follow and just believe. He said, "Try to understand." So that was really nice that he could... He said, "Please try to understand, don't follow." Mm-hmm. So that was one point, something brought that to my mind. When you talk about he's speaking about the truths being squashed as the moment they come up, reminds me of a television reporting person, a news reporter. Somebody had brought some truths toward a political thing, who knows what, but he was a real gentle, mild-mannered person there to present some truths, and this monster would take the truth instantly and twist and manipulate in order to fulfill his agenda of keeping the mainstream world from hearing this truth. You twist and manipulate, and you could see it unfold.
Yeah, and we all have experiences in our own life also. I remember like when I was growing up as a little boy, and I was like three or four years old, I asked my parents who Jesus Christ was, because I heard all this amazing stuff about Jesus Christ. I want to know from them, who is Jesus Christ? And they said, oh, we don't believe in Jesus Christ. So right after that, I didn't believe in Jesus Christ either. So just little things like that on little people make a big difference. Just like all these little children, they're growing up with faith in Krishna, right? Because they're living in a protected environment. And they have such wonderful faith in Krishna. It's so nice to see. And by the same token, and so many other little children, they have faith in everything else. Because as soon as and little children, it's natural for most of them to believe in God. So that natural spirituality is being squelched by the materialistic environment. And just look, see how long it took so many of us to become devotees. Of course, it was all Prabhupada's mercy. But we had to fight so much opposition, so many obstacles, just to be able to manifest Krishna consciousness in our lives. The parents, the pressures of school, pressures of society, pressures of our own material desires that had grown as we had grown just because of the way things are in this world. So much we had to overcome. Those are the Putanas and the Kamsas, the false gurus of this world. Television, I don't know who named it the one-eyed guru, but definitely is. I don't know what they call the computer, but probably it's even worse. Television, you only have a certain number of channels. Computer, you have like, it's unlimited. Anyone else? Yes, Prabhu? One-eyed Paramahamsa. Okay. Yes, Prabhu.
Thank you, Maharaj. You mentioned that Prabhupada's guru told him, if you ever get money, print books. And I remember at one point, correct me if I'm wrong, did Prabhupada say if we get money, we use 50% for book distribution and 50% for, you know, other things? I was just wondering if that is true.
Right, 57% for book distribution, 50% for
temple construction or something. I don't know what it was.
I forgot also. Because in order to... what are the results of book distribution? The results of book distribution is an international society of devotees. And so Prabhupada constructed temples. Right? Also, because temples are necessary. So is your question, why aren't we spending all the money? No,
I'm wondering what the mandate is. Is it 50%? Because if that is true, and if we followed that, my God, a lot of books would go out. And Krishna consciousness would be spread really quite rapidly, I would think. I don't know if that's true or not. I think I read it, but I haven't read everything, so I'm asking you, what's the proper commentary on that? Because I would like to see Krishna consciousness spread like anything.
The proper commentary is to distribute as many books as possible. Every situation is different, and we're living in changing situations. So just like South America, we can't even get books into the country now, because the Argentine customs is, they stopped all Indian imports, Chinese imports. Then the books are printed in China, and they found out that in the ink there's a certain chemical, there's a certain something that has to do with the feathers of some bird, I don't know, whatever it is. And so they're saying that this is not good for the health of the country, so they're not letting the books in the... It's just such a crazy situation down there. In many parts of the world, it's not as easy as it is in this part of the world. Every situation is different. So I'm not really qualified to give a mandate for every situation. But we know that we can never stop, never neglect the importance of distributing as many books as we possibly can. And we should always feel pushed. That's one thing that Prabhupada established in all of his disciples. He pushed us like anything to distribute books. And never let us forget the importance of it. I mean, it's obvious if you think about how important it is to distribute books. It's obvious. Hearing is the basic principle. Having association with the spiritual master, hearing from the spiritual master. So everyone has to hear. Everyone has to have a book. Everyone has to study the books, etc. So it's obvious how important book distribution is. We can't hide behind anything else. And that was Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's instruction to Prabhupada. And that was Prabhupada's instruction to us. So we can't forget it.
Maharaj, I just want to let you know, this is a brand new outfit for Radha Kala Chanji, made by the devotees from Dallas.
Oh, very
nice. Yeah. Good
question. Usually they're made in India. Is that why you're saying from there? And who made the outfit?
Some ladies from the community.
Some lady, okay.
Some ladies. Set of ladies.
A few ladies made the outfit. Oh, thank you, ladies.
Quick question. Do you think when Prabhupada wrote his purports, did he actually dumb it down a little? His English, did he dumb it down a little? Or did he just present it the way his English was? Because you can understand the gradation of how English has progressed. When Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur read Prabhupada's poem, The Offering, Absolute Ascension, Thou Hast Proved, it shows that Prabhupada was very intelligent. His English was super brilliant. Do you think when he wrote his purports for the Western audience, was it a little dumbed down in terms of English usage, not the message?
I don't think so at all. I think Prabhupada expressed himself. I don't know. I never heard that. I would never say that. I would never speculate that at all. Narottam, were you wanted to say something? No, I mean, did you have your...
Yeah, thank you. Hare Krishna, Maharaj. It's wonderful to see you. Thanks for coming tonight.
You too.
Thank you for speaking. I did hear something from my Guru Maharaj that Prabhupada, he wrote like the Bhagavad Gita and the books very simple for that, so that even a young child, my Guru Maharaj mentioned 10 to 12 year old, so that anybody who picked up the book, like I picked up a book when I was 17, and I could easily, you know, understand it and practice it. So he mentioned that to me once, that Prabhupada did write it, you know, in a simple format so that anybody could have access to it. And I know there's a famous Acharya from the Madhvacharya sect who he also writes comments on Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita. And he mentioned in a visit to Vrindavan that what Srila Prabhupada was able to do in one or two paragraphs, as far as explaining, it would take himself, he was referring to himself, 25 pages to write the same, cover the same points. So Prabhupada mastered that. And I think there's a saying like that, that concise... essential truth spoken concisely is true elegance. Eloquence, thank you. Eloquence. Thank you very much. But my question has to do with Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati and our practical everyday preaching. When I read Sri Bhaktisiddhanta Vaibhava, there was the section on the transcendental exhibitions, and I was really inspired by that, and to do those like major you know, cultural expos, and not just have them open to the public for people to walk through, but where he engaged so many of the senior devotees in preaching and explaining everything. And so my question has to do with, one, you know, should we put our energy into developing something, you know, like, for example, what Indraduna Maharaj is doing, you know, with a large public expedition, you know, exhibit, or should we just do the simplest things possible, like just get out there with our books, or you know, like we used to go set up our book table at the library or the zoo, and you know, or should both things go on? You know, in other words, how much energy should we actually put forward? You know, practically, you have so much experience with this in actually, you know, reaching out like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati did.
I would say that every devotee should preach according to his or her capacity. Just like in a community like this, I'd be happy, I'm sure Srila Gurudev would be happy to see devotees preaching in any way at all. Getting the devotees out in whichever way they feel inspired or they can contact the public. To have a big, you mentioned Indradumna Swami's festival program, I think that's a little far reaching. I think, just like he started very small, if the devotees start small and they feel inspired to organize more and get more facilities, then that's great. I think everyone should start somewhere and see how far they can take it. One step at a time, that's what I would say. Because we're living in a community of householders and everybody has so much responsibility, family responsibility. So I don't think it's practical. If we set our goals too high, then we'll fail. We won't get anywhere. But if we set some practical goals for ourselves and for the community, then we can make gradual progress. So I would say it's so nice to see any type of preaching, any type of outreach going on. It's so inspiring to see that. So inspiring to see devotees pushing themselves to go out or to help the preaching in some way. That's what I would be very happy to see, that everybody's doing something according to their capacity.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. So I had a question about one of the last sentences that you read. I'm not quite sure I understood it completely, and you had to move through it fast. It was about how the existence of the Putanas is a boon to theism. I think I understood it that way because their own hypocrisy will be their downfall or something like that.
That sounds good. Very nicely put.
Protecting pure bhakti. It's like can't enter the rasa dance.
The effect of silencing of the whole race of pseudo-teachers of religion is the very first clear indication of the appearance of the absolute truth on the mundane plane. Before that?
Maybe the third to last sentence.
Oh, here it is. Well, I'll start the paragraph. Stay with me. But as soon as the theistic disposition proper makes its appearance in the pure cognitive essence of the awakened soul, Putanas are decisively silenced at the very earliest stage of their encounter with newborn Krishna. The would-be slayer is herself slain. This is the reward of the negative services that the Putanas unwittingly render to the cause of theism by strangling all hypocritical demonstrations against their own hypocrisy. But Putana does not at all like to receive her reward in the only form which involves the total destruction of her wrong personality. Devabrasta Prabhu? He's going to go on to explain, I think. But Putana does not at all like to receive her reward in the only form which involves the total destruction of her wrong personality. King Kamsa also does not like to lose the service of the most trusted of his agents. The effective silencing of the whole race of the pseudo-teachers of religion is the very first clear indication. So Putana and Kamsa, they don't like this. That's what I get. They just don't like it.
Can you explain the part of the strangling hypocrisy thing? What exactly going on?
Strangling hypocrisy. This is the reward of the negative services that the Putanas unwittingly render to the cause of theism by strangling all hypocritical demonstrations against their own hypocrisy. They're also what? This one? This is the reward of the negative services. You want me to skip to that? The bona fide teacher of the Absolute heralds the advent of Sri Krishna by his uncompromising campaign against the pseudo teachers of religion. The Putanas, they also destroy. And now we're bouncing back and forth a little too much. Why don't you look at it? I think it's. I'm just taking the whole paragraph into consideration. I think the beginning sentence and the last sentence sums it up. That the Putanas are silenced, the very earliest stage of their encounter with Krishna. The bona fide teacher of the Absolute heralds the advent of Krishna by his uncompromising campaign against the pseudo teachers of religion. That's enough for me. I'm okay with that. Yes, Guru.
Maharaj, referring to this negative service, I know Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati is famous for being very negative in the sense that he would, you know, really focus on the pseudo-religionists and, you know, all the bogus philosophies, and he would just openly, you know, in a very, like, clear but a very heavy way show publicly that it was wrong. And I know he commented, Bhakti Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati commented that that's necessary in this day and age, rather than just being nice to people.
Well, I was wondering if it's not a question of rather than being nice to people.
Okay.
It's a question of presenting truth and presenting it palatably. What is it, satyam?
Palatably?
Yeah. That's.
There's a verse in the Gita that speaks the truth. And the austerity of the speech is to speak.
There's a letter to Yagyeshwara, because I knew you were going to bring this up. Regarding your questions, your first question was, should the devotee always speak the truth to everyone in all circumstances? The answer is yes, one should always speak the truth. But qualified devotees will be able to speak the truth always very palatable to everyone, so that it will sound pleasing even to his enemy. That is the art of speaking truth. It is certainly so that we must speak the truth to all people. It is certainly so that we must speak the truth to all people. But how you say it, that is another thing. Satyam bruyat priyam bruyat. When you become yourself little more experienced in Krishna consciousness by preaching work, and if you are sincere and serious to make progress in spiritual understanding, you need not have to worry yourself further, because the truth will always be spoken by you in the proper manner. Just like Prabhupada, he spoke He spoke the same thing in many different ways to various people and in various circumstances. So we have to understand, just like, I'll give you an example. Like sometimes, if I know I'm going to be seeing people again, like the first time they mentioned something to me that's a misconception, if I felt I've helped them advance a little bit and I'm going to see them again, then I won't even touch what they said. I won't even mention it. But next time I'll say something. If people aren't ready to hear it, if I'm telling them it's preaching to the unfaithful, and it could discourage them from coming back. There's a certain way that I use for helping people understand, and it's not necessarily the first meeting that they have to hear everything, and they have to be smashed and defeated every time. Otherwise, it won't work. I've found. Or just like I was in Arlington with who else was there? With Arjamil. We were doing kirtan at a yoga center, the yoga center in Arlington. And Ajamil is very enthusiastic about presenting the truth. Especially after a kirtan, he'll say, you know, so many things. And this is the only way. And so I instruct him, I have to remind him, that don't say this is the only way. And don't put anybody else down. I have to remind him. So we had an ecstatic kirtan. I don't know if you remember, Babanga. Ecstatic kirtan, the yoga center. And I always like Ajamil to say a few words because he's so very attractive and when he's blissful. So he takes the microphone. He says, you know, Maharaj, he told me not to say this. But Prabhupada is the only guru who came over from India who taught anything of value. You remember when he said that? I was going, oh my God. We're sitting there with all these yogis who have their gurus and their spiritual masters and they're following us their own spiritual path. And so I said, Ajamil, what'd you say that for? He said, well, I told him you told me not to say it. In other words, he got me off the hook. So why should I be so upset? But what he said was true. But these people aren't ready to hear it that way. We're just like Prabhupada didn't tell the devotees about the four regulative principles until they were initiated. Until after that first initiation, then he put up the sign on the refrigerator, all initiated devotees must follow the four of these. So we have to be a good judge of time, place, and circumstance. It's not a cut and dry thing.
Bhakti seemed to feel that it was a waste of time to accommodate, you know, people's misconceptions that you may not have another chance or they may not have another chance to actually hear the truth. And so accommodating them wasn't actually an act of compassion, but rather it was supporting their misconceptions and sinful activity. And it was actually leading them further into darkness by being, you know, supportive of those misconceptions. And so I'm just bringing that up because it seems from Srila Prabhupada's letter that you read, that was a letter from Srila Prabhupada, that Prabhupada did take a different approach.
No, he wanted the devotees to speak the truth, but speak it palatably in a certain way. Definitely.
So there's no better way of presenting the truth than simply speaking the truth, but it's the palatable aspect of it, the sugar coating of it, personalized.
Yeah, and there's also a way of saying that Prabhupada was the only one that taught anything without saying that.
But it seems like, for example, Radhanath Maharaj in his book Journey Home, or in his approach, he's like accommodating everybody. He's got, you know, I mean, he's showing like, here, look at this.
But he's not speaking the truth, just like Bhakti Tirtha Swami. I went to, I didn't go to, I heard it, a lecture that he gave at Brown University. All sorts of people came to that. Black people, white people, people from Africa, people from Muslim, all sorts of people. And he spoke in such a way that everyone was attracted. And they invited people to the Institute of Applied Spiritual Technology. And so many people came, and so many people became devotees as a result of that. People from those backgrounds who wouldn't have come in any other way. So there's a way to present the truth in a palatable way. Not lie, but there's a way to present it in a very palatable way. And I'm sure if he was asked a certain question, is God personal, impersonal, said, he would have answered it in a way that, well, he would have spoken the truth, but in a way that would have been attractive to people, because he had the potency of being able to do that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
But then, you know, then there are people who were challenged. Well, it's so many situations. And Prabhupada got very angry at a pandal at one Mayavadi. I mean, there are some people who've heard it, and they just, you know, and there are innocent people that need to hear the truth, and there are rascals that need to hear the truth, and sometimes it's very, very advantageous just to let it all out. But we can't imitate Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur either. We can't imitate Srila Prabhupada. I rather err on the side of caution than take the chance of destroying somebody's faith. I can't think of an example of that at this point, but I mean, that would be my general posture. Yes, Prabhu.
Thank you, Maharaj. You were mentioning earlier that one of the best ways to preach is so even that your enemies, they understand it's palatable to the enemies as well.
That's what Prabhupada said, yeah.
And I believe a great example, if you could please help me with the names, I'm a little lost with the names, but in Krishna book, in the very beginning, during the wedding ceremony, when the voice from the sky alerted Kamsa to who will be killing him, and that, you know, this your sister, I'm not sure, the eighth son of your sister will kill you, and here you are, you know, taking her to her husband's house, her husband's home, and then the brother of her sister began to stop Kamsa with a philosophical discussion, pretty much. And Kamsa, being a great demon, was convinced not to kill his sister at that moment, even by the explanations of her brother. So we can use his example, that the way he preached to Kamsa, as a way that, and this was in a very simple, not sugar-coated way whatsoever, and very mm-hmm. palatable, and no compromise whatsoever. And that method of preaching and what he said was capable of warding off Kamsa from killing his sister at that moment in time. So I think it's a great example.
There's another example of Narada Muni when he's being chastised by Daksha, really heavily. You know what Narada Muni said to him? Nothing. It was just the right thing to not say, or to say absolutely nothing. And Daksha's anger completely, he became completely pacified. So that's another way to preach sometimes. Yeah.
Say that slowly and clearly.
Yes. All right, cool down. He totally sugarcoats it when he speaks to Kamsa. Vasudeva is totally glorifying him for his being an awesome king and blah, blah, blah. So much sugarcoating that's going on there. He's trying to figure out what to do You know, he's all, everything's going on the fly right now. He's making things up, trying to...
Well, you know, when it's a question of life and death, you know, like if someone comes to kill your kids and you're hiding your kids under the bed and he says, where are your kids? You don't say, well, they're under the bed. I can't tell a lie, right? So in circumstances like that, anything goes. Yes, Prabhu.
One example that I remember, Prabhupada's lecture, when I first came to New Vrindavan in 72 for the Bhagavad Dharma discourses, you know, his universality, you know, he gave a lecture, he's speaking about religion, how one Hindu can become a Christian, people can change their faith, you know. So philosophically, he was, Prabhupada also like a lion. Sometimes he would blast tremendously, you know. But in Paris, he spoke to this, most likely you heard the lecture.
Colonel Daniel Lou?
No. He spoke to a very professor from a very high university. And the man was a scholar on the history of India, on the Vedas and all this, you know. And then after the man left, the devotee said, yes, Prabhupada, you defeated him and this and that, you know. And Prabhupada said, no, he is a scholar. He's acknowledged in France as a great scholar, you know. So Prabhupada, it sort of threw me off because I was a young devotee when I heard the lecture, you know. And by listening to Prabhupada constantly, you know, in the kitchen in New York, we listen to Prabhupada's lectures again and again and again, you know, like everywhere, you know. And I learned that he was like a lion at times, just like Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, but he could see, he could be as soft as the rose of a petal. Prabhupada was so, you know, sometimes unexpected. In London, he was talking to a Buddhist monk. You most likely heard that one too. You know, they talk for a long time. And the Nirvishesha Shunyavadi, we know that, you know, how Prabhupada feels about the Buddhist philosophy or the Vaishnava tradition. But the conversation didn't touch philosophy. Prabhupada was discussing different aspects of the Veda, talking about, you know, spiritual practice. And he invited him to stay that night at the London Temple. Mm. So sweetness... it's great in preaching. It's my personal experience. You know, you get more with honey than vinegar.
Mm. Thank you, Prabhu.
For those who listen to the Bombay morning walks, Srila Prabhupada speaks. He's speaking very fiercely with all the Indian students. There's some Sanskritists, there's some one guy, he's reciting Bhagavad Gita, the whole thing from memory. There's all kinds of people there, but you find that he doesn't fight every point. Some of the points he's very fierce and arguing with these students are very eager to argue with him. After a few weeks of walks, you can see that they become a little bit more submissive. Mm. But there's some points you could see, oh, this is a point that Prabhupada could argue. This is a misconception that the kid presented. But Prabhupada doesn't always attack every single little point. And so what was suitable, that he felt that was necessary, mm-hmm. he spoke on. But it wasn't every single little thing that he has. Mm.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank all the survivors for staying. So late, so long. It's really a great pleasure to be back here again. Looking forward to seeing you all real soon. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami Maharaj, Prabhupada ki, Gaur Premanandi, Srila Prabhupada ki, Jai.